בוקר טוב, בוקר טוב. I was recently asked by some organization to give a presentation on the Rav on Tu B'Shvat. It's a very nice idea, except that I never heard the Rav give a Tu B'Shvat shir. And various writings, and I only have about 50 books in my house that are the Rav's library, as we say. I don't recall any article, or any particular shir, that was delivered on Tu B'Shvat specifically on the subject of Tu B'Shvat. However, there's much material in the Rav's thinking, halachic thinking, and philosophical writings that address the issues of Tu B'Shvat. For openers, we have to realize that Tu B'Shvat was never considered a Yom Tov. We have upgraded it. When I say we, the last 600-700 years, in the days of the Middle Ages, we've upgraded into a type of pseudo Yom Tov, or the language of the Poskim, Miktzat Yom Tov. Miktzat Yom Tov, a pseudo Yom Tov, doesn't carry with it Isur Malacha, there's no work prohibition, there's no particular mitzvah of the day, neither biblical nor rabbinic. It's just, it's a slew of customs. And as we know in the world of customs, of minhag, you can have different areas, local custom, and there's hardly any universal minhag that's associated with Tu B'Shvat, although some seem to be somewhat related. And when we talk about the Mishnah and the Gemara and the Rambam of the 12th century, the only thing we know about Tu B'Shvat is that it's a technical date, a target date, that is necessary for the performance of some of the agriculturally bound mitzvot that relate to trees. And they are the truma giving to the Kohen, which biblically you can give just a minuscule, but rabbinically approximately 2%. And then an additional 10% is taken off to the Levi, Maaser Rishon. And then there's Maaser Sheni. And Maaser Sheni is taken off 10% from what remains, and it's simply brought up to Yerushalayim to eat at your next possible visit to Yerushalayim, be it a Yom Tov or some other occasion. And the halakha allows for the redeeming of those fruits of Maaser Sheni, to redeem them on money, because maybe the fruits and vegetables may spoil by the time you plan to get to Yerushalayim. So then you can just transfer it into cash value and take it up to Yerushalayim on your next visit and buy ice cream and pizza. You don't have to have fruits, agricultural produce, but you have to eat. You have to buy food, edible food. Now, some people think ice cream and pizza is not exactly edible food, but all right, for those who do consider it, fast foods edible, that's what you do in Maaser Sheni. So why is it important to have a target date? When is the birthday of a tree, or a fruit for that matter? Because every seventh year, the Shemitah year, there are no Trumot and Masrot. So you have to know, does this particular fruit or vegetable belong to the previous year, the sixth year, or does it belong to the next year, which might be the seventh? Or is it the seventh year, where there's no Trumot and Masrot? Or perhaps the fruit belongs to the eighth year already, and you do have to take it, which is the first year of the next Shemitah cycle. So it's important to assign dates. With regard to vegetables, so Chazal have to also give a moment that would be considered the birth of, or rebirth of. So the question is, there's so many different stages in the production of fruits and vegetables. At what point do we say that now, from now on, it's the new year? And if a plant grew up until a certain maturation point, then it belongs to the previous year. If it passed the maturation point, then it's part of the next year. So with regard to vegetables, broadly speaking, it's Rosh Hashanah, our Rosh Hashanah, Tishrei. But with regard to fruits, it's Shvat. And as Machloket, the dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, is it Rosh Chodesh Shvat, or is it the 15th, Tu B'Shvat? Fine, that's a shir in itself, and I'm going to do that once we talk about the difference between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. But it's Shvat, it's not Tishrei. That's what's important. But the Mishnah tells us there are four target dates for Rosh Hashanah. The first of Nisan, the first of Elul, the first of Tishrei, and the first of Shvat according to Beit Shammai, and the 15th according to Beit Hillel. And each one has to do with completely different areas of halacha. The only common factor is that they're all called Rosh Hashanah. Chassidut Chabad invented a fifth, the 19th of Kislev, Rosh Hashanah LaChassidut. I'm not saying it in a facetious way. That's another concept that they have as a Rosh Hashanah. But the idea of Rosh Hashanah LeIlanot, or as is classically referred to in the sources, Rosh Hashanah LeIlan, even though all the songs have it in the plural, Chag LeIlanot, but the Chazal were pretty careful about their language, and there are some good reasons why it was given in the singular, Rosh Hashanah LeIlan. There is a Mishnah in the continuation of that Masechet Rosh Hashanah, in the fourth chapter, that deals with all the laws of blowing of shofar. And it's the fourth chapter, begins, Yom Tov Shal Rosh Hashanah Sheichal Liyot B'Shabbat, when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbat, B'Mikdash Tokim, in Beit HaMikdash, they would still blow the shofar, even though it's Shabbat. Ve'avol B'Medina Lo, outside the Beit HaMikdash area, Koyit HaRambam, outside Yerushalayim area, they did not blow the shofar on Shabbat. As we know, we don't blow the shofar on Shabbat. We don't even do it even in Yerushalayim today. That too is a shir in itself. But that's the Mishnah. So the question is, why did that Mishnah begin with the headline, Yom Tov Shel Rosh Hashanah Shechal Liyot B'Shabbat? Why, if it just would have said, Rosh Hashanah Shechal Liyot B'Shabbat, Rosh Hashanah that falls on Shabbat, and we see immediately that the subject matter is Tkiat Shofar, the blowing of the shofar, everyone would have understood, we're not talking about Nisan, we're not talking about Elul, we're not talking about Shvat. So we're talking about our Rosh Hashanah of Tishrei. So why does it say, Yom Tov Shel Rosh Hashanah Shechal Liyot B'Shabbat? So I heard from one of the great American rabbis, Kadosh Baruch Hu Yarich Yamav, Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, my dear rabbi from Young Israel of Kew Gardens Hills, who quoted the Rav, and I heard this from him many times over, so I always remind myself to quote Rabbi Schoenfeld, I heard it from him, who quoted the Rav, and the Rav said that this was done deliberately to forestall an era that you may think that the other Rosh Hashanah are also Yamim Tovim, but they're not. Neither the Rosh Hashanah of Nisan, nor the Rosh Hashanah of Elul, nor the Rosh Hashanah of Shvat, according to Beit Shammai, or Tu B'Shvat, according to Beit Hillel, they're not Yomim Tovim. Yom Tov Shel Rosh Hashanah Shechal Liyot B'Shabbat is only one of the four Rosh Hashanah, and that's the first of Tishrei. So we do understand that there is really nothing of a Yom Tov status. However, the fact that we've upgraded into a pseudo Yom Tov and beyond the target technical date to know if the fruit belongs, and I say fruit now, not vegetable, because vegetable, the target date is Rosh Hashanah. If the fruit belongs to a previous year or the next year, for so many of the agriculturally bound mitzvot, you have to know, is it a Maisa Sheni year, is it a Maisa Ani year? And you have to know, is it a Shemitah year, is it not a Shemitah year? How we relate to the fruits. And this special Rosh Hashanah, that we have this target date, Am Yisrael has given it an additional dimension because of Chibat Haaretz, to cultivate a love for Eretz Yisrael, being far away from Eretz Yisrael for so many years. It's a diaspora invention. Now I say a diaspora invention, so many of you will say, one second, aren't many of the Tu B'Shvat customs emanating from Tzvat in the 16th century, the Kabbalists? The answer is yes, but they didn't make it up. They embellished it. They upgraded it to some level, to the extent that the idea of a Seder Tu B'Shvat that comes out of the Kabbalist world is something that they were trying to put Tu B'Shvat on some level, equating it with Pesach. When you say a Seder, you always think Leila Seder, and you don't think Tu B'Shvat. I can tell you that in all my years in the States, I never heard of a Seder Tu B'Shvat, and only coming to Eretz Yisrael, all of a sudden, it's like it's a new invention. What is a Seder Tu B'Shvat? And you have to study it, you have to learn it, and so on. What is it? And you'll see certain customs of drinking four cups of wine and saying all kinds of songs that have to do with the seven species of Eretz Yisrael. Everything's very nice, it's very colorful. And I say again, different communities have different ways of expressing the Tu B'Shvat. But from a purely halachic point of view, it's not at all a Yom Tov, it's just a target date. But having given it some Yom Tov status, So the only way it really impacts on our halachic life is that this morning in davening, and today for mincha, and also yesterday for mincha, we deleted the saying of tachanun. Mm-hmm. Deletion of tachanun is a statement. It's a statement. I mean, it's not a very, very strong statement of how significant the day is, but nevertheless, it's a statement. When the Rambam talks about the idea of saying tachanun, he teaches us, contrary to popular opinion, that it's not something that comes after Shmon Esrei, but he says that it's an integral part of Shmon Esrei. The Rambam lists 8 halachot of Shmon Esrei, things that we all know are part and parcel of Shmon Esrei. The idea that we stand and not sit, the idea that we bow at the proper times, the idea that we say Shmon Esrei in a low voice and not yell out loud. So many different halachot are clearly Shmon Esrei halachot. So the Rambam says in the 8th, when he says 8 things, is what we say tachanunim at the conclusion of Shmon Esrei. Which means the Rambam saw the tachanunim as an integral part of Shmon Esrei. What people fall in Tfilat Apayim, which once upon a time they used to really cry. And the Rambam believes, in theory, that every single Shmon Esrei, just whether it's weekday or Shabbat or Rosh Chodesh or Yom Tov, just as every Shmon Esrei, even though the content of Shmon Esrei changes and adjusts according to the season, every Shmon Esrei must necessarily have the proper bowings, must have standing, must have low voice. All these halachot are there for every single Shmon Esrei. The Rambam believes that every Shmon Esrei is supposed to carry also tachnunim. Why is there tachnunim? What does that mean? What's the concept? The concept is that there are 2 ways of approaching a Kadosh Baruch Hu. One way is to make an appointment with God, and you are the minister. And when you have your minister, so sar lefnei hamelech, as the Gemara calls it, you have an agenda, you have an appointment schedule, and you know what you're going to say. It's organized, and that's what Shmon Esrei really is. It's within a framework of time. There's a dress code, by the way, for Shmon Esrei. I mean, you don't have to get oiske putz, you know, for every mincha, but you can't daven like a schlep. I mean, I used to have this out with some of my cohorts in camp in the summer, where some of the fellows felt that it was very, very important, you know, to have a black hat on during mincha, even though they were smelly from all the... I said, you might as well take a shower first and then daven without a hat. That's much better than, you know, coming in all for schmutz from the ball field and then putting on a black hat. You know, that's not the way you come to Kadosh Baruch Hu. You're supposed to come to Kadosh Baruch Hu every tefillah on some level that you'd feel comfortable appearing before a melech. So again, it doesn't have to be, you know, big day Shabbat and Yom Tov, but it has to be somehow presentable. And let me just digress for a second, but just you're going to remind me now where I am, because you know that I need help sometimes. So the Rav was once asked, and this is going back into the early 70s, when Rav Lichtenstein, Zichron Lebracha, came in Aliyah, 1971. So the Yeshiva Haratzion is a Hesder Yeshiva, and Rav Aaron used to go back to the States to interview the next year's crop of the Chutz Laretz students coming. So the Israelis sometimes would ask Rav Lichtenstein to be a shliach, to be a messenger boy, with shilas that they would have for the Rav, because they had no contact with the Rav. But obviously they knew Rav Aaron, the son-in-law of the Rav, he's going to meet him. So the Rav Aaron gracefully did this. So one of the famous shelot that one of the chayalim, the talmidim are all chayalim, they're all soldiers, they asked Rav Lichtenstein to ask the Rav. Says they were in, his job is to clean tanks. Just to get an idea of what you look like when you finish cleaning a tank. I mean, the grease and the grime, I mean, all over you. And it was almost sundown, and he didn't know whether he'd be able to daven mincha at that time, or should he spend the time changing and showering. By the time he gets that done, it's going to be after sundown, and then it becomes a less appropriate time to daven mincha. And the Rav's response was that the uniforms of Tzahal are big day kodesh. Are big day kodesh. And there's no need to change.
Including the dirt.
Including the dirt. He said, this was big day kodesh. He says, the Rav responded to Rav Lichtenstein, I don't understand the Shaila. He says, they're big day kodesh. Why should you want to change? Because there's nothing more holier than that. This is the Rav, who some people claimed that he wasn't such a tziyani. All right, so let's just drive that out of our system. All right, where was I? Get Rivka, do?
Tachanun.
Tachanun, thank you. I plant people here, you know, too.
Or the shill.
What?
The shill.
Okay, fine, thank you. Tachnun. So, with regard to Tachnun, the Rama believes that every Shmon Esrei deserves it. Then what is Tachnun? It's the opposite of meeting a Kadosh Baruch Hu as a minister. It's meeting a Kadosh Baruch Hu as an infant. And an infant doesn't have words. An infant knows one thing. It needs to eat. It cries. It does, you know, a tantrum. And Tachnun used to be a tantrum. It used to be pishut yadayim raglayim, getting on all fours and banging on the floor and yelling and screaming. Less important in Tachnun was the text. More important was the yelling. And that's called Eved Lifnei HaMelech. So sometimes an Eved Lifnei HaMelech has a better shot to get into the royal chambers than a minister. A minister has to make an appointment. But their servant is bringing in coffee and cake. So it can always get. Now, if you had some, you needed protexia, if you needed to get to the king or prime minister or president, but you know the people who work in the kitchenette who bring in the coffee and cake in the middle of the cabinet meetings, that's a good shot. That's Eved Lifnei HaMelech. So we use this flip side of how to get through to God. So Rambam believes that even Shabbat Yom Tov we should have Tachnun, but he admits Minhag Pashut. Minhag Pashut is a phrase, catchphrase in the Rambam, which means doesn't mean simple custom. It means a custom that spread. Shehit Pashet in modern Hebrew. A custom that succeeded in spreading throughout the nation. Minhag Pashut. That on Shabbat and Yom Tov we don't say Tachnun. Why? Because it was inappropriate to go through that tantrum of crying on a day of Simcha. Today, people don't even know that Tachnun is a moment that you're supposed to cry. It's said so ritualistically and just said like, you know, Perek Tehillim and nothing more than that. So, but in days of old, people did understand that what the rationale was of Tachnun. So the idea was, on Shabbat and Yom Tov, it's just not appropriate. So they dispense with saying Tachnun on Shabbat, and on Yom Tov, and on Rosh Chodesh, and Chanukah, and Purim. But he does, and he mentions Rosh Hashanah, but Yom Kippur, he says, oh, Yom Kippur is a day of that we're begging God for forgiveness. What do you mean dispense with Tachnun? Now Ashkenazim don't say Tachnun on Yom Kippur either. As the Maharam Rutenberg pointed out, to us Yom Kippur is also a Yom Tov. And it's not just Yom Tachnunim. So that's a shir in itself. Why? What's the difference of Machloket between Rambam and the Chachmei Ashkenaz on Yom Kippur? But the list in the Rambam is very, very stingy. You open up Shulchan Aruch and you see the list becomes expanded. And you see that's Rabbi Yosef Karo. And that's a few hundred years after the Rambam. And then his younger contemporary in Krakow, the Ramo, Rabbi Zizlis, expands the list even further. But if you take it all the way to the modern day calendars that every Gabbai, you know, looks at before every davening to make sure, God forbid, we shouldn't say an extra Tachnun. So the list is like almost there are, you know, days, there are clumps of days that we don't say Tachnun. The whole month of Nisan, and from Erev Yom Kippur until Rosh Chodesh Cheshvan, and from Rosh Chodesh to Sivan until the 12th of Sivan, all kinds of blocks of days that we don't say Tachnun. Plus other days, like Ba'omer, the 15th of Av, and the 15th of Shvat. These are days we don't say Tachnun. Not saying Tachnun is a statement. We're saying that there's something special about today, and therefore, there's some element of simcha associated with it, so it's not appropriate to say Tachnun. Just as if a Baal Brit means either the father or the moel or the sandak, shows up in shul, so that minion doesn't say Tachnun, because everybody's caught up with the simcha that there's a Brit in shul that day. So that's important. Or for chatan and kala. And I stress kala, because I once had this in Ramot, where in mincha, in the afternoon, somebody told me there's a kala in Sheva Brochas upstairs in the Ezrat Nashim. So my first question was, where in the world is the chosen? I mean, where is he? I mean, they're supposed to be together. This happened at YU in the shir of Rav David Lifshitz, Zichron Lebracha. A guy got married 3 days later. He comes to shir. Rav David Lifshitz gave it to him over the head. He says, the week of shir brachas, you're not allowed to be without your wife. Go home. Next day, he came with his wife to the shir. So I wanted to know, where is Kala's husband? What, but he davened early. So where was she? You know, like, you know. So okay, but the answer is that if the kala is in shul and you know about it, and she's in the week of Sheva Brachas, you don't say Tachnun for the same reason. It becomes everybody's simcha. So simcha is a mitigating reason why we don't say Tachnun. And the fact that we don't say Tachnun on Tu B'Shvat like we did this morning is an indication that we've made it. We've instilled in Tu B'Shvat some measure of simcha, even if it's minute. That doesn't make a bit of a difference. You know, by Chassidim, if it's the Rebbe's Yortzeit, also because they've They've made the yahrzeit into a Yom Aliyat Neshama and so on. I remember in Borough Park there was a calendar that had every single day some Rebbe's yahrzeit. And this was a shtiebel that didn't want to discriminate against any Rebbe, so they never said Tachton the whole year, except for it's interesting, and I'm not joking, I didn't make this one up, that there was one day in the year no Rebbe ever died. It's the 5th of Iyar. It happens to be Yom HaTzmut. The 5th of Iyar. One day a year, there was no yahrzeit. This shtiebel said Tachton once a year on Yom HaTzmut. So nobody should suggest that the reason why they deleted Tachnun on Yom HaTzmud, because it's Yom HaTzmud, you know. But the fact is that in the yeshiva of Ponovich, in the Rosh Yeshiva, the Ponovich Arov, Rav Kahana Manzatzal, who himself was a Holocaust survivor, and he comes to Eretz Yisroel and founds the yeshiva of Ponovich. So on the first Yom HaTzmud, and then it became company policy of Ponovich until this very day, even though it changed management, it's under different policy. They fly the Israeli flag once a year, and they do not say Tachnun on the 5th of Iyar. And the rationale of Rav Kahaneman was, I'm not a bigger Tzioni than Ben-Gurion. In all likelihood, Ben-Gurion's not saying Tachnun today, I won't say Tachnun. In all likelihood, Ben-Gurion's not saying Hallel, so I won't say Hallel either. Besaviv Ben-Gurion, we don't have to be. But the fact that he was willing to delete Tachnun in itself was a statement of acknowledgement that there's something special about the 5th of Iyar. So this is the halachic import of Tu B'Shvat. You know, it's a Gabbai's dream. So you get out of shul about 45 seconds earlier, especially if it's a Wednesday, it's a short tachnun anyway. So that's the whole big deal. But the story really begins, in terms of the Rav's thinking and teaching, on the level of talking and discussing about Eretz Yisrael, that perhaps during the year we may not touch on the subject, but these were very favorite topics by the Rav. He used to speak annually in the Thanksgiving Day weekend in the States at the Mizrahi conventions. They were published first in Yiddish, and then translated to Hebrew, and then subsequently to English and other languages. Phenomenally, phenomenal masterpieces of oratory expression of religious Zionism. So he would refer to his grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav of Brisk, as he would do in his halachic talks all the time. But here, we know that before World War II, the rank-and-file religious Torah-oriented community was not a very Zionistic community. We know that. Today, we can most probably cry about this. It was very sad that this was the case. There were a handful of names that you can name from the late 19th century and early 20th century. Rav Reines, Rav Kalischer, Rav Kook. You can pick them out and mamash, count them on your fingers. How many were there from the Gedolei Yisrael who were pro-religious Zionism at the time? Most of them were either apolitical, you know, they just didn't have an opinion one way or another because they didn't know how to deal with it. And some were downright anti, you know, against, very much against. And what we know today as the line of the Neturei Karta, of the Satmach Sidim, that there cannot be a Jewish state before the coming of Mashiach, was not a Satma ideology. It was most of the Gedolei Yisrael's ideology of Agudat Yisrael. What happened in 1948, things changed. There was a state. So Agudat Yisrael actually shifted gears, and they said that they will partially recognize the state. Partially. So you know that in Agudat Yisrael circles, there's no flag, there's no atikva. A lot of things they don't have, but a lot of things they do have, like participation in government and so on. So there are things that they made a conscious decision to cooperate with the new reality. But the Rav went further, and he too, before the war, was part of the Agudat Yisrael orbit. So much so that his only visit to Eretz Yisrael in 1935, he was then 33 years old, he was candidate for Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv as the Aguda candidate. And he got slaughtered in the election to the Mizrahi candidate, Rav Amiel, who came from Antwerp. The Rav changed his colors after the war, and he became a card-carrying Mizrahi member. He used to brag about this at the conventions. He thinks he might be the only one who pays dues, because you know how Jewish organizations are. You get the bill in Rosh Hashanah time, but not everybody pays the bill. He was very careful to pay the bill. But they crowned him honorary president of Mizrahi. That obligated him for one thing only, to come to these annual conventions and give the keynote address, and that really brought in the crowd, you know, to this, and they were really masterpiece drashot, But he identified. He identified. He had things to say. He wasn't a yes man. He was critical of things that sometimes happened in the Medinat Yisrael. But in the same time, same token, he was ever grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that this was happening, and so on. So indeed, he was on an outside of the fence, one of the only of the Gedolei Yisrael. So he claimed that his grandfather Rav Chaim, who most probably was known as one of those anti-Zionist, says my grandfather wasn't really so anti. He thought he was more apolitical. He didn't really take a side, yes or no. But he said that you can never have accused him of not being a lover of Tzion. Because the way he expressed it, the way any Lamdan from Brisk would express it, is by studying the Torah of Eretz Yisrael. And what's interesting is that in the classic Lithuanian yeshivot, from Volozhin to Mir to Kamenetz to Ponevich and Baranovich and Radin and Grodno, and these are great names of the yeshivas in Vilna and in Kovna, they studied what we call the classical Mesichtot. They studied Masechet Seder Nashim of Ketubot Yevamot and Gittin and Kiddushin, and they studied from the Sikh Nizikin, Baba Kama, Baba Matzia, Baba Batra, maybe Masechet Makot, maybe Sanhedrin. And that's what they studied. And they just had a rotation of these Mesichtot over and over again. But nobody ever delved into Seder Kodashim that dealt with Beit HaMikdash areas. It wasn't on the agenda. It's not a practical thing. So there were two Rosh Yeshiva who actually introduced Seder Kodashim into the syllabus for two different reasons. One was the Chofetz Chaim in Radin. And the reason why he did it, he was a Kohen. And the Chofetz Chaim felt that perhaps the reason there's no Beit HaMikdash today, because there's now Kohen who's appropriate, who's trained to do the Avodah in Beit HaMikdash. So we have to study the Halachot and start from ABC. You know, this is an area of Halacha that we don't even know the alphabet. So we have to delve into this. So he put this into the curriculum of the Yeshiva of Radin, Seder Kodashim. But Rav Chaim Soloveitchik in Brisk did it for a different reason. Because it was uncharted territory. They're here, we don't have all the classical great Achronim, after the Rishonim, the great halakhic thinkers, nobody wrote anything. There are no svarim on it. You have to go back to the Rambam. You have to go back to the Gemara itself. You yourself can start playing the role of the great Rishonim of the 12th, 13th, 14th century. Because nobody's really dealt with these subjects. And that's why the Rav Chaim felt that there was a lot of halakhic creativity that was waiting to be developed and unveiled through the study of Seder Kodashim. And until this very day, in the Brisk Yeshivot, the various tentacles of it, in Gula, in Yerushalayim, if somebody wants to study Seder Kodashim, you go to Brisk. Everybody knows that. That's what they study. That's their forte, if you may. So the Rabbi said, Reb Chaim, he had issues of Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, Kedushat Makom, on his head every single day. You can't get a better Zionist than that. Obviously, this wasn't political Zionism. It was a Zionism on a completely different level. But in this regard, the Rav would liberally quote his father and his grandfather on the issues at hand that could be appropriate for us today in the modern state of Israel. For example, we go back to Parshat Lech Lecha, and we see that there's a map of Eretz Yisrael that HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises Avraham Avinu. That map is a wide map. It goes from the northeast to the Euphrates River, Nahar Prat, and it goes south all the way to Nahal Mitzrayim. Nahar Mitzrayim is a machloket between Rashi and Rabbi Sadia Gaon. Rashi says it goes all the way to the Nile River, the Nilus. It's already Egypt. I mean, it encompasses the entire Sinai Peninsula, beyond the Suez Canal, and up to Cairo. Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon says, no. It's only up to Wadi El Arish. El Arish cuts the Sinai Peninsula exactly in half. And that becomes the western border, the southern western border of Eretz Yisrael. And the truth is, without getting into a dispute ideologically between Rashi and Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon, Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon was absolutely correct in terms of his description of the Nahar Mitzrayim from a geographic political point of view. Am Yisrael never went beyond there until 1956, when we took over the entire Sinai. And then again in 67, where we took over the entire Sinai and we were there for a while. Until 73, when Arik Sharon brought the troops on the other side of the Suez Canal, and we were very, very close to the Nile River. That was the first time in the history of Am Yisrael that we were so close. But in terms of the classic map of Eretz Yisrael, it goes into the Wadi El Arish on the south, west, and the northeast to the Euphrates River. It was pointed out already by Rav Yoel Ben Nun that the first time the map of Eretz Yisrael is introduced in the Chumash are the borders of Gan Eden. Borders of Gan Eden that are surrounded by four bodies of water. And one is the Parat. It names the Euphrates as one of them. And the others are just alluded to. You have to delve into the Midrashim to see that this is this border, this is the Mediterranean, this is the Yam Suf, and so on. And therefore, the conclusion is that where is Gan Eden? We're in it. The problem is you read too many newspapers and you think you're in Gehenna. But this is not Gehenna. If you stop reading newspapers, you see it's Gan Eden. And I can recommend reading newspapers once a year in this country. Erev Yom HaTzmaut. The edition of every newspaper on the eve of Yom HaTzmaut, you can kiss every word. Because all it talks about is the miraculous accomplishments of this country. All of a sudden, for one day, all the narishkeit is put on the side. All the slanderous news items not dealt with. It can wait till Motzei Yom Tov. But on Yom HaTzmaut, when you read a paper, you're going to read about the unbelievable miracle that's in 70 years now that's called the State of Israel. So to a certain degree, we've made a shtickl Gan Eden here. But Rav Yoel Ben Nun said, this is the map. Now that's a large map. Now that map is halachically called Olei Mitzrayim. This is the map of conquering Eretz Yisrael in the days of Yeshua. Now Yeshua didn't take 7 years. That was just the first act of the conquering of Eretz Yisrael. It takes 400 years till David HaMelech. Yerushalayim is liberated in the days of David HaMelech from the Yevusi nation. It was an enclave holding out. And finally, David HaMelech incorporates it into the map of Eretz Yisrael. And only then could we build the Beit HaMikdash. And David thought he was the man. Kadosh Baruch Hu had other plans. It would be his son Shlomo and so on. But the map takes over 400 years to complete itself, the first conquering of Eretz Yisrael. But it's called halachically Olei Mitzrayim. This is the map of those who ascended from Egypt. But then there was a Churban, and the Churban, the destruction of first Beit HaMikdash, caused the abolition of the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael to occur. And then we, by license, returned to Eretz Yisrael. And by license, not everybody jumped for joy. Matter of fact, 95% of Babylonian Jews decided to stay put, as we know. The taking of the settling of Eretz Yisrael in the Second Temple era is on a much smaller map. And the boundaries are enumerated in the Mishnah and Masechet Gittin, that Akko was already a northern boundary, Ashkelon was a southern boundary. So you can see that this is not exactly the great map. It's a very, very small map. And that map then has Eretz Yisrael sanctified anew. And according to the Rambam, which then becomes the dominant view, that sanctification of Eretz Yisrael is never abolished in spite of the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash and continues until this very day. So we now have an oddball situation. We have a map within a map. The map within a map, the Olei Bavel, as it's called halachically, is a map of Eretz Yisrael that enjoys Kedushat Ha'aretz, sanctity of the land. The larger map, Olei Mitzrayim, does not have Kedushat Ha'aretz because it was abandoned or abolished with the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. So why do we have to know about the two maps? So the Rav quoted his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, in the name of his father, Rav Chaim, that there are two concepts of Eretz Yisrael. This is classic brisk. Two. Split. Two concepts of Eretz Yisrael. One is called Shem Eretz Yisrael, the name Eretz Yisrael, and one is called Kedushat Eretz Yisrael, the sanctity. There are some halachot that do not require as a necessary prerequisite that the land be sanctified in order to fulfill the mitzvah, or in order to be obligated in the mitzvah. And in those mitzvot, and in a moment I'll give you the details, in those mitzvot, it makes no difference which part of the map you're in, whether you're in the Olei Bavel or Olei Mitzrayim. You are obligated and you can fulfill mitzvot of Eretz Yisrael. Those mitzvot, that the requirement is the name only, Shem Eretz Yisrael. While there are other mitzvot, that there's a necessary halachic prerequisite, that in order for a mitzvah to be binding, there has to be kedushat ha'aretz, sanctification of the land. And those areas, and only those areas, are those mitzvot binding today. And that's the smaller map. That's the map of Olei Bavel. Now this is very important for us today. Because take, for example, in the Shemitah year, so many of us prefer not, you know, financing the coffers of our enemies on various sides of the borders, and would rather not purchase exclusively Palestinian produce. That's not a big mitzvah, putting a model. But on the other hand, taking into consideration the halachic problems with the sale of Eretz Yisrael as a solution to some of the Shemitah prohibitions, there is an Israeli solution, and that is to buy produce from areas of the state of Israel that are outside the boundaries of the smaller map, Olei Bavel. So while there is Eretz Yisrael there, not only from a modern legalistic point of view, state of Israel, it's Eretz Yisrael in name, and therefore it's Israeli produce. But if that area does not have sanctification of Eretz Yisrael, there are no Shemitah restrictions. Now I remember we came on Aliyah in 79, so that Rosh Hashanah, Tavshin Mem, was a Shemitah year. And that was an education for us, because in Chutz Laaretz we never dealt with Shemitah. And I remember going shopping in a super sal, and you had to go with a sal, right? Remember the salim, right? I still use it. A sal, and a Tanakh. Because the signs indicated from where the fruits and vegetables came from, and one of the signs would read, Parshat Mas'eh. Now if you go through Chumash Bamidbar, Parshat Mas'eh, there the borders of the Brit Ben Haftarim, Parshat Lech Lecha, are given in great detail. Mamash, every corner. In Avraham Avinu, it's just broadly spread out. But in Parshat Mas'eh, it's mamash detailed map. So it tells you that these vegetables are beyond the border of Parshat Mas'eh. So in order to know if you're going to buy these tomatoes or not, you have to open up a Chumash. And you have to see what the story is. And I never used a Tanakh when I went to shop in Walbaum's in Queens. Never needed a Tanakh. Right? But here, you needed a Tanakh to know where the boundaries are. It became a completely different experience. Let me just give you some examples of those mitzvot of Eretz Yisrael that do not require the sanctification of the land, but all we need is the name Eretz Yisrael, and hence these halachot can be fulfilled in the larger map of Olei Mitzrayim. One is the idea of giving smicha. Now, we use the word smicha today as a reminder that once upon a time there was such a real thing called smicha. So our smicha today is nothing but a pseudo smicha, and it's based on a halacha, Talmid al yoreh ele imkein natal reshut mirabo. Gemara says this in Maseret Sanhedrin that a Talmud, a student, should not render a halachic decision unless he receives permission, prior permission, from his own Rebbe. Why is that? This is predicated on the idea of kavod harav. You yourself, as a Talmud, to your own Rebbe, have to have kavod. So if somebody asks you a shaila, and your Rebbe is still alive and well and kicking, so Chazal say, Divrei HaRav, Divrei HaTalmid, Divrei Mishom'in. If you have a choice to hear the psak from a student or a Rebbe, you go to the Rebbe. So this Rav, who was now asked the Shaila, but his own Rebbe is still alive, and from him he received the tradition of Torah, he's obliged to turn to his Rebbe and ask him the Shaila. And then go back to the questioner and give the response. Okay, in theory. And that's because of Kovar Rav. But the Rav can say, you know what? You know, this is all before cell phones and text messages and so on. I know some of the high school kids don't even believe me that there was such a world like that, but there was. So, and the Rebbe can be in a different country already. you can move to a different country. So what do? So the Rebbe can authorize you. He can deputize you into being a posek. He said, you know what? I think you're good enough. I think you know the material. I think you've seen me in action. That's called shimush tamidei chachamim. You've seen me in action. You've accrued the necessary experience, apprenticeship by me. Go out and paskin shaylos. That's called smicha today. Talmid al yoreh ele im kein natal reshut merabo. And this kind of permission granted is applicable both in Eretz Yisrael and in Chutz Laretz. Is absolutely not one bit of a difference where the Rebbe gives that smicha. But if you go back to the days of Moshe Rabbeinu giving smicha to Yeshua, that smicha of Yeshua is now where we say in Pirkei Avot, Moshe kibel Torah misinai misarah de Yeshua, Yeshua leskenim, and so on. And it goes down generations. Generations. Rambam cites 40 generations from Moshe Rabbeinu till the end of the days of Gemara. But it's not all the way till the end of the days of the Gemara, Ravina, Ravashi, several years before. In the era of Abaya and Rava in Bavel, but now I'm limiting myself to Eretz Yisrael, that's where the real smicha was given. And there's a whole procedure of how smicha is done. It's in front of a Beit Din, almost like conversion in front of a Beit Din. There had to be three, Beit Din of three. And the candidate for smicha had to be proficient in all sections of Torah, even though the smicha authority can grant him smicha only on a limited part. You can't come and say, I want smicha just on halachot of Shabbat. You have to be proficient in kol ha-Torah kula and everything, but the Rav can say, you can only paskin a shayla in Shabbat or another area of halacha. That's their prerogative. The deciding, the degree granting Beit Din, if you may. But this procedure could only take place in Eretz Yisrael. Could only take place in Eretz Yisrael. And now we understand why the procedure collapsed in the fourth generation of the Amoraim of Eretz Yisrael. Because there was no longer a sustaining Jewish community at that time. And without a sustaining Jewish community, there's no Torah learning and no Torah excellence. And everything moves to Bavel, Chutz Laretz. And that's why there's no longer a title, Rabbi. In Bavel, in the Talmud Bavli, the title was Rav. In the Talmud Yerushalmi, the first generations, it's Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Rabbi Avin. The Rabbi is still there, which was the title for somebody who received smicha. Nobody in Bavel received smicha, because smicha is not given there. It's not given there. The transition takes place with the movement of Torah from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. So why is this halacha a halacha in Eretz Yisrael? What does it have to do with Eretz Yisrael? So in source number one, you thought we'd never get to the page, right? In source number one, the Rambam says, Ein somchim zkeinim b'chutz laretz. Zakein is not old people. It means wise people. Zaken mi shekaneh chokhmah. When the Torah says shivim zkenim, 70 elders, it doesn't mean old people, geriatrics. It means wise people. Ein somchim zkenim chutz laretz. Avo pi she elu hasmuchim, hasomchim nisbechu be'eretz Yisrael. Even if the Beit Din, the members of the Beit Din, receive smicha themselves in Eretz Yisrael, and now they're in chutz laretz, they can't give smicha in chutz laretz. Why can't they give smicha in chutz laretz? What's wrong with chutz laretz? I mean, the student knows the Torah less because he's in Europe or in the States or in Australia. I mean, what's the difference? Why is this a factor? So the Rav explained that the giving of smicha, it's not the authority of these three dayanim of the previous generation. It's the authority is vested in Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael. They're the ones who give smicha. Because the authority that the subsequent generation will have is not just to render a halachic decision, but also to serve on a Beit Din for various issues that may deny you your personal wealth in a particular litigation, and they'll take the money away from you and give it to somebody else. They may have to give you malkot because you performed a certain avera. In theory, it could be a capital punishment. It's not human beings personally that are meting out these punishments. It's Klal Yisrael that's doing it. But Klal Yisrael has certain shlichim, has certain agents that do it on behalf of Klal Yisrael. And the Rambam tells us elsewhere that the very definition of Klal Yisrael, the definition, what is Klal Yisrael? So you might say, the Jewish people. So you want to know how many Jewish people? You go to the Pew report and you see how many Jewish people you have in different countries. That's not the definition of the Jewish people. According to the Rambam, the definition of Jewish people is the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael. That's the Jewish people. Everybody outside, this goes over very well when I speak about this in Chutz La'aretz. They love it. They invite me to come back for doubles. The Rambam believes that all our wonderful brethren in Chutz La'aretz, to use the Yiddish, are mishpucha. They're family. They're related to us. But it's not Klal Yisrael. It's not Klal Yisrael. The Rambam says, even if the numbers go down to 10 Jews in Eretz Yisrael, that's a minyan. That's Klal Yisrael. Everybody else are related. And in one of the illustrations of a mitzvah that requires Eretz Yisrael, but does not require the sanctity of the land, is the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctifying the moon, and establishing the calendar, the leap year. So according to 99.9% of the poskim of the Middle Ages, today we rely on an emergency measure that took place 1700 years ago by the great-grandson of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, whose name was Hillel, but not the famous Hillel, he's known as the second Hillel, Hillel HaSheni. And he convenes a Beis Din that based on the astronomical calculations of the 19-year calendar that just repeats itself, he does an act of Kiddush HaChodesh until Mashiach comes. So that's why every month already was Mekudash, and all you have to do is get a calendar from your local Amit, Amuna, you know, Shiva Bnei Akiva organization with an envelope on Erev Rosh Hashanah, and you're all set. Well, go to Shul, but you know, here, Rosh Chodesh Shvat, here, B'yom Revi, Abal Leinu Tova, you know when Rosh Chodesh is. But it's the sanctification is already behind us, long time ago. The Rambam's the only one who dissents and says, no. We are still sanctifying the moon. How do we do that? There's no Beit Din. There's no witnesses showing up. We saw the moon, B'chidusha. No. Ram says that there's an automatic switch track. If the Beit Din system is inoperative for whatever reason, we automatically go to track two. And what is track two? It is the observance of the day as Rosh Chodesh by Klal Yisrael. That means when Jews in Eretz Yisrael observe the day as Rosh Chodesh, by including Yalev Yavo, by saying a partial Halil, by having Kriyat HaTorah, by having a Tefillat Musaf, by some women customarily not doing certain activities on Rosh Chodesh, by not fasting and no eulogies, all of these things are the laws of Rosh Chodesh. Here in Eretz Yisrael, we give halachic energy to the piece of paper that's called a calendar. That's what does it. And then the Rambam says, and gives a hypothetical scenario. Let's assume, just for a moment, that there would not be a minyan of Jews in Eretz Yisrael in any given Rosh Chodesh day. And before he even gets further, he interjects and he says, Chalila lakel me'asot davar kazeh. God forbid this would never ever happen. Why? How is the Rambam so sure that it would never happen? Because God promised that the Jewish nation would never be obliterated. And not having 10 Jews in Eretz Yisrael is called the obliteration of Klal Yisrael. Even though there might be 10 million Jews outside. That's called Am Yisrael's extinction. And that was promised to us that would never happen. So therefore, the 10 Jews in Eretz Yisrael observing the day as Rosh Chodesh then allow the Jews in Melbourne, Australia, and in London, and Paris, and Los Angeles, and wherever, to observe the day as Rosh Chodesh. And not only that, but if we would have a scenario where, God forbid, there wouldn't be at least 10 Jews in Eretz Yisrael observing the day as Rosh Chodesh, and it happens to be Rosh Chodesh Nisan, that year there's no Pesach for anybody. For anybody. Because where does Pesach get its halachic energy? From Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And if it happened to have been the Rosh Chodesh of Tishrei, so that year there would be no Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot. And if it happened to be Kislev, that year would be no Hanukkah. And if it would be Adar, that year would be no Purim. Nothing. It's all based on the Rosh Chodesh of that month. And the Rambam says that he tries to expand on this, why Am Yisrael is responsible for the sanctification of the calendar, because it says Hachodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim Rishon Hu Lachem. It, the Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm not going to do this for you. You do this. And that's why in Musaf we say, Baruch Ata Hashem, Mekadesh Yisrael V'Rashei Chodeshim. And on Yom Tov, Mekadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim. Because it's Am Yisrael that does it. Bakasha.
And how does he explain that it started in Egypt?
So that question was raised. It's a very good question. The question was raised already by the Gemara itself. And basically the Gemara suggests that everything that happens when Am Yisrael leaves Mitzrayim, it's already for shadowing that which is going to be Eretz Yisrael, and it answers a lot of questions. The question is a good question, but the basic answer is that it's all in movement towards Eretz Yisrael, and so things already of an Eretz Yisrael nature kick in, and the laws become ironclad after Am Yisrael enters into Eretz Yisrael. At that point, there's no longer a possibility of these mitzvot being performed in Chutz Laretz. And this has to do with Eretz Yisrael. So if you look at the last line of source number one, the second to the last line, it says, V'chol Eretz Yisrael shechziku ba olei Mitzrayim ru'uya lasmicha. So which map of Eretz Yisrael is necessary for the giving of the smicha? The larger map. The map that just has the name of Eretz Yisrael, and not, we're not concerned about the sanctity of the land. Another, so you have now two examples. Kiddush HaChodesh also. Kiddush HaChodesh has nothing to do with the sanctity of the land, but it has to do with Eretz Yisrael. Because if it's a function of Klal Yisrael, it can only be done in the area where Klal Yisrael is so defined. And it can be anywhere in the larger map. But take another mitzvah, which is basic. The mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. Yishuv Haaretz. So the person have to live in the smaller map of Olei Bavel in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz? The answer is absolutely not. Because the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael is not linked to the sanctity of the land, but it's linked to the place that's known as Eretz Yisrael. And the it's interesting that before the destruction of the Yishuvim in Gush Katif, so there were many, many plantations there, fruits and vegetables that came into the country, to the centers, and there was below, this is south of Ashkelon, and those fruits and vegetables were also Shemitah free in terms of being issues, no less than, let's say, the Arava, going down from Sodom all the way to Eilat, and so on, and other areas in the country. So we are familiar, but all those who live there fulfilled the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz, no doubt. No doubt. There are some poskim, the Rambam doesn't have this, but are some that believe that the only place that there is Yishuv Haaretz is when there's Jewish sovereignty over the land. If you don't have Jewish sovereignty, so you don't have the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz. And that's why I remember in 1981, when Menachem Begin, Olav Shalom, his government, voted to apply Israel law to the Golan Heights, so the Rabbanim of the Golan made a big Yom Tov, and they said, according to those other opinions, now we begin fulfilling the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz, because Israel law has been applied to the Ramat HaGolan. So you have now that, and there are other mitzvot that are dependent upon just the name. But the mitzvot that are agricultural, and they are the Trumah, the Maaser, and all the agricultural mitzvot, they are limited to the smaller map, to Olei Bavel, because those mitzvot, as a necessary halachic prerequisite, have to have the sanctity of the land. So how did the land become sanctified? So the Rambam tells us, in the first Beit HaMikdash era, it became sanctified by the conquering, the conquest. By the conquest. And the conquest was done by Yeshua, all the way up to David HaMelech, over 400 years of activity. Of military activity. But when the Babylonians came and conquered the land, so they basically undid the conquest of Yeshua until the days of David. And that's why the Kedusha, the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael, faded away, just fizzled out. Because that which caused the Kedusha to kick in was then eliminated. But in Beit Sheni, the second Beit HaMikdash, there was no conquest at all. We didn't shoot a bullet, as they say. There's no conquest. We returned by license. And all we did was started building. We fortified the walls of Yerushalayim, and then we started building outside Yerushalayim. It was what the Rambam calls chazakah. We got our hands on it, and that is settlement. It became an activity of settlement. So the Rambam says that's why that sanctity remained, because we never, even though it was an exile after the second Beit HaMikdash, and the truth is the exile wasn't really after the second Beit HaMikdash destruction, but after the Bar Kokhba revolution failure, 65 years later, that's when the real Galut took place. But nevertheless, there were always a handful that remained in Eretz Yisrael to guard the fort, as they say, to watch the store. And that's what the Rambam means. There was always a garrison of Jews in Eretz Yisrael throughout the ages. And therefore, we never relinquished on that chazakah. I mean, you know, maybe Abu Mazen should come to the shir also and listen to this, because it would be very helpful for him to understand the situation, the halachic situation. But the Rav wanted to do better. He wanted to explain a little bit what the Rambam meant, that chazakah, the settlement, was of a stronger type of hold on Eretz Yisrael's sanctity than conquest. Now, just to be fair, not everybody agrees with the Rambam on this. Rashi, for example, is of the opinion that just as the first destruction abolished the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael the first time around, so too did the second Churban, the second destruction, undo the Kedusha the second time around. And according to Rashi, from the days of Beit Sheni, the land is not Kadosh. So Rav Goren Zatzal has a big Chidush and claims that with the State of Israel, even according to Rashi, we've re-sanctified it. Beseder, he has a case. He has a case. But according to Rambam, it never was lost. But what was not lost? The smaller map. The map of Olei Bavel. But the Rav wanted to know, what's so qualitatively better, the hold on Eretz Yisrael, the chazakah, than the conquest? Why the first time around the sanctity was lost, second time around the sanctity was not lost? And the Rav said as follows. This is a very, very big, a very novel idea. Yerushalayim. When did Yerushalayim enter into the picture the first time around? And that is the first Beit HaMikdash. When did it enter into the picture? At the very end of the saga called Conquering Eretz Yisrael. David HaMelech. And that is 440 years after Yeshua. Because the Navi says with Shlomo HaMelech when he builds Beit HaMikdash, says it's 480 years after leaving Mitzrayim, and there were 40 years in the desert. So 440 years later, finally, Yerushalayim is in our hands. And it's almost the end game of conquering Eretz Yisrael. Whereas in Beit Sheni, the process was just the opposite. Just the opposite. It all started with going back to Yerushalayim. Ezra and Nehemiah are given license by Persian authorities to rebuild the walls, to start inviting people to Yerushalayim, planning to build Beit HaMikdash, and from Yerushalayim, it grows outward. To use an analogy in the language of nuclear physics, this was a difference between fusion and fission. We know there are two ways to have the atom give out enormous amount of energy. You can split the atom, and then it releases tremendous amount of energy. That's called fission. Or you can group atoms together, forge them together, and that releases even more energy, and that's called fusion. An atomic bomb over Nagasaki and Hiroshima was fission. A hydrogen bomb is fusion. The sun manufactures its energy by fusion, by the way. These are different ways of energy producing. To a certain degree, what happened at Beit Rishon, with regard to Yerushalayim, it was actually fusion. And that is, everything came together, finally, around Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim became the purpose of unity, of unifying the people. Before that, there were 12 tribes. The Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim was the calling for unification. And that's why the city of Yerushalayim was never divided amongst the tribes. Yerushalayim lo nitchalka l'shvatim. It is the real estate of Klal Yisrael. Forever. It was a process of fusion. Beit Sheni was just the opposite. We came back to Yerushalayim and then it explodes into other settlements. It's a process of fission. It breaks out. It breaks out. So the Rav said, the settlement activity in Bayit Sheni is a direct result of coming from Yerushalayim. And with regard, putting the whole discussion aside as to the sanctity of the land, there's another discussion, the sanctity of Yerushalayim. And the Rambam says the sanctity of Yerushalayim and Beit Mikdash was never destroyed, neither the second time nor the first time in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. Why? Because it became the seat of the Shekhinah, of God's resting place. And you can bring all the armies in the world, and they cannot unseat HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Ramar says, Be'olam lo zaza Shekhinah me'al gabei kotel ha-maravi. The Shekhinah, the presence, never left the western wall of the Beit HaMikdash. Not necessarily our kotel, but it's the western wall of Beit HaMikdash, which means there's Shekhinah there forever, and we have to acknowledge it. And this idea that from this type of Kedushah Yerushalayim that was never abolished and never abandoned, come forth a whole settlement activity, so Yerushalayim is jettisoning sparks of Yerushalayim holiness upon the rest of the land. And hence, every settlement outside Yerushalayim is imbued with some spark of Yerushalayim itself. And as Yerushalayim sanctity was never abolished, now the sanctity of the land is never abolished either. But that's only relevant for the second Beit HaMikdash era, and that's why the smaller map is the map, the Olei Bavel, is the map that's actually sanctified until this very day. There is a halakha that the Sanhedrin, well, we one day we're going to do it, because we're already beyond the bracha of Borech HaShanim, which is the bracha of Talu Matar in Eretz Yisrael. And not only Baruch Hashem do we have rain this year, but it talks about the rejuvenation of agricultural activity in Eretz Yisrael as it began in 1880. This is the first stage. And then comes Kibbutz Goliot, the next stage. The next bracha in Shmona Esrei, Mekabes Netchem O Yisrael. And what's next on the agenda? Hashiva Shoftenu Kvo Shana. It's the implementation of the prophecy of Yeshayahu that we read on Shabbat before Tisha B'Av. After you've heard the whole Haftarah of Chazon Yeshayahu in the Niggun of Eicha, the Valkyrie goes over to Ve'yashiva Shoftayich Kevarishona Ve'yotzayich Vaklila Acharechen Yikarei Lach Ir HaTzedek Kiryah Ne'emana. The reconstitution of the Sanhedrin, because they have the ability to expand once again the sanctity over all parts of Eretz Yisrael. As Yeshayahu predicted, Harchivi Mikom Ohalech. The tent is just going to expand. And that's going to happen soon. It's going to happen very, very soon. Who knows? We know that from a demographic point of view, in just 10 to 15 years' time, majority of Am Yisrael will be in Eretz Yisrael. The last time that happened was 2,600 years ago. 2,600 years ago, with the exile of the 10 tribes. And it's going to happen again. We should all be well. Everybody should have a good health and witness this great event, because things are going to happen here in Eretz Yisrael. Things are going to happen, for sure. And God willing, you know, what we have all these years in Tu B'Shvat, that we never let go of our commitment to Eretz Yisrael, is only growing deeper and deeper and deeper. And in Yisrael Hashem, we'll see the manifestation of all the great nevuot of great Nevi'im.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.